Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Mass Construction Rundown.
So I think this is going to be a good one this morning. I'm very interested to talk about why lifelong residents are leaving Massachusetts. So I think that's going to be an interesting one for a lot of the listeners. And I'm hoping we'll get some comments from people because, you know, they lay out why they think people are leaving, and they really think it's about housing is why people are leaving. But I tend to think it's probably a lot more than just high cost of housing that's making people leave Massachusetts. Important note, there's lifelong residents leaving Massachusetts.
Right.
We're gonna talk about solar bonds, what that means. And then just overnight, Scott Van Voorhis posted his Contrarian Boston Substack. And there's a couple of interesting things in there. One of them was about nuclear power, and I think that will tie with our solar bond conversation. And then there was some information from a report around cost of construction in Boston. So I think that's worth chatting about. Both of you saw that Suffolk had that construction site fire yesterday.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that ties into, we're going to talk about pay by project, pay by speed, whatever we're going to call it.
Yep. No, good point. Yeah, there's a new software that has come out that they're hoping to be able to reward employees based on, you know, the speed and quality with which they finish a project. So if your team comes in and finishes the project under budget, you basically get a bonus. So, and it's meant for craft workers as well as project managers and everything. And the question is, is there safety implications
right
with that? But back to that, the cell station job. So it sounds like slag from a welder on an upper floor that landed on the lower roof and caused the fire. That's right on the heels of the beam that fell down. What was that, 2 weeks ago?
Right.
About that.
Which is right on the heels of the state legislation requiring the certifications for welding, and we have our, you know, FPPM requirements. I mean, that's a lot, and we still had an accident, or an incident, I should say.
In the state, there's, I forget who, if it was, I think, I believe it was in the Senate, Nick Collins is putting forward a bill to have criminal penalties on, you know, willfully ignoring the building and fire code and causing
right
harm with
yep
some pretty stiff penalties in there. So that will be interesting. I think that cell station tower job has got its hands full. I was also hearing from folks that they've hired, it sounds like there's like a third party, what I would kind of call a quantity surveyor, but basically counting every bolt and washer and everything for every slip that's coming through, and it's creating a lot of heartburn over there on the payment side. So,
well, unfortunately, the GC has seen their share of issues over the past year or so. You know,
yeah, 2 years.
That can't be helping that general contractor. Yeah. So,
Chris has my favorite quote of all time: "Quick, cheap, or quality? Pick one."
Right.
No, pick two, right?
Yeah.
You can do it fast and cheap, but it won't be good quality. You can
do it
good quality and fast,
yeah,
but it won't be cheap. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, Chris, if you're interested, it's called Protiv, Protiv. It's a software platform that is trying to incentivize employees. It'll be interesting. I'm not sure if it gets much traction, but I think there's some inherent issues with the way incentivizing speed,
yep,
for individuals. But let's get to lifelong residents leaving Massachusetts. It was from Boston Indicators, I believe, was the group.
Yeah.
And the report was mass migration. And, you know, what kind of jumped out at me was, they said what has happened is over, you know, the past years, we've been having lifelong residents leave, a lower number of births and a higher number of deaths. So there's like a natural loss of people because when people living here aren't having kids and there's a lot older population and more people are dying. So there's that natural loss of people. And then the people that are moving out to other states are being backfilled by international migrants coming in. So that's been kind of holding us steady. I'm just paraphrasing for the people listening. That's what's been holding us steady. But now over the last 2 years, 2021 and 2022, out migration of current residents has superseded the amount of international people coming in. And now we're starting to lose population. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I'll just say straight out, when you have a state that has essentially a one-party system, other than the fact that we've had Republican governors over the years, but you essentially, in all other aspects of politics, you have a one-party system, essentially, that's not very appealing to people, and people get a little bit fed up with it. So I think people are just, you know, there's other places to go that essentially, the way people look at it is there's more freedom in other locations, right? There's more ability to do things, you know, in other states. So, you know, this state has this, in some municipalities in the state, has this image of being cavalier and being the first ones and being the, which is great in some aspects, but I think that's the same aspect of politics that's turning people off, not just politics, finance and whatnot. So I think that's turning people off, and people have just had enough of it. You know, they see that there is other places to go, other places that are trying to maintain some semblance of a two-party system or a balance. And I think that's what you're saying. People are just fed up.
I saw the other day on Instagram, I forget which page it was, but Massachusetts is the second most expensive state in the country. Hawaii's first, and then it was Massachusetts.
Yeah, people are shocked to hear that. You know, I've you never know how much stock you can put in these things, but I've read on a number of occasions that housing is more expensive in Boston. And this was even pre-COVID stuff, more expensive in Boston than it is in New York now, which I found kind of hard to believe. But it's definitely a major issue. And to Mike's point about a one-party system, Mike and I have chatted enough, and it's not one or the other. If we go to some, you know, Republican state that is just as lopsided, you're going to have all the same
way.
You know, but when you don't have balance in anything, when you don't have balance, it's a problem. And you're right, there's a lack of balance here. There, you know, this report really ties people leaving to the cost of housing.
Yep.
You know, and I think that's this group's kind of thing. And that's certainly part of it. I think the cost of housing is part of it, but I think generally the amount of just piled on regulations frustrates people.
Yeah.
Yep.
Not just in the building and real estate world, but in just in general life.
Yeah.
I recently closed on a property out of state, and you know, it was so simple compared to my home here in Massachusetts that it was stunning. Like, it was, you know, 5 pages to sign, and it went so seamlessly and so easy. And then
and it was fast, right? Like, wasn't the whole process just
extremely fast, much less paperwork. Everybody was happy. You know, it was no attorneys, just a title company that looks at it, does the work. It costs a lot less. It was just easy. And I kind of feel like here in Massachusetts, less and less stuff is just easy to do. And I think that goes to people trying to run businesses.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
And you know, the amount of hurdles that we see that get put in front of small business owners. I saw it so many times when I was at plans and zoning phase at ISD, that people come down with a dream and it gets crushed because the you know, they're just, you know, like, I just want to open a convenience store. I just want to open a barber shop. Like, why is, you know,
no, why? It's, you can go on websites, but most municipalities, even, you know, Podunk USA in Massachusetts here, they have handbooks, right? How to do business in, I don't know, Westport, how to do business in whatever. And when you thumb through those books or you scroll through those pages, the amount of red tape it takes to open a business before you even get to the inspection part, which we've talked about, like, you know, and have the inspector come out or any construction, it's amazing how much red tape there is, you know, and I've always played both sides of it. And like you said, Massachusetts, I think it's got to be one of the worst, am I saying worst, or one of the most difficult, as far as, you know, you have local requirements and you have state requirements, right? Yeah. And it's just, they pile up and it just beats people back. And then you have the municipality who, you know, a lot of times beats people back, even though it's small business, and can't see the, you know, the fact that it's economic development, right? There's got to be gray area. There's got to be the ability to see people through to get businesses open, right? But Massachusetts, yeah, it just seems, and being on the regulatory side for 20 years, right? I would see both sides of it. So I just, when I go to other places and I talk to building officials or I talk to family members who live in other states, it doesn't seem that they're dealing with the same situation that we are here in Massachusetts with the bureaucracy. And, you know, it seems, I do it when I teach. I'm like, look, you're going to pay for your tests. And you're going to pay Massachusetts for your license, and you're going to wait even though you paid them for your license, and you're going to wait for 5 or 6 weeks, and you're probably not going to be able to get a hold of anybody on the phone. It's tough. It's tough. Yeah. But
no, it's a great point, because it gets back to a lot of the regulatory stuff we have been talking about, which is these regulations get put in place, and then there is not municipal staff to deal with all this stuff, and they just keep writing, adding new laws and adding new regulations and new ordinances, and then there's not the people there to deal with it. You know, not to pick on Boston, but like, look, we have this 2 safety affidavits in Boston,
right?
Why?
Yep.
You know, like, that can't be just put on one affidavit, right? You know,
right?
We gonna say something, Rich?
No, I mean, I was just gonna say, like, about a situation last year with the state that I was dealing with, and you know, the answer is just immediately no, right? Like, to your point, like, it's not like, let's sit down and have a meeting. Let's talk about it. Let's try to really understand the request or the proposal. It's just no, like, and that's it. It's not like a collaborative approach to trying to understand a situation that might be out of the ordinary, that might be this might be the first case where someone's come to the table. And the answer, it was a state process, but the answer was just no, we don't allow it, we don't do it, no, can't do it. And you know, it's really a turn off.
Yeah. And then having to you know, I know the situation you're talking about, and then like having to reach out to a state rep to just, you know, help you. And that's what the state rep's for. You're not doing anything underhanded, but like the fact that you have to try and go to your state rep to get an agency to work with you is absurd, and it crushes small businesses that wanna get up and running.
And what if you don't have like the contacts or, you know, the ability to reach out to people to try to navigate a system or a process? It's definitely not a user friendly. It's not for the people. It doesn't support small businesses. It doesn't support any, you know, it's just, the answer is just always no, at least from what I've seen, my experiences. And to get things done, you really need to go to like the next level, the higher level, which not every small business owner or person, like you said, with a dream has like the right contacts or knows how to do that.
Yeah. In other states where the reverse is true. I mean, I'm going to have someone on from the city of Providence. And when we were chatting, one of the things he said was, yeah, listen, like if Providence is right for you, if you want to chat with us, reach out. We want to talk to you. You know, we'll turn you around a permit and we'll get you going and we're going to make it happen. Like, that's the attitude, you know,
yeah.
And I think that's what we don't have here. I think we've had a historic, well, we've had the meds and eds, and people are always going to just put up with whatever we put in front of them because we're Boston and people want to come here and they want to go to the schools and they want to go to the hospitals, and that's our economic engine. And we can just keep piling on, but I think people eventually get fed up. But I think the InRed, if you can keep an eye on the comments too,
yeah,
I think we had a couple
coming.
The thing that really stuck out in that report was the people that were leaving.
Right.
It was 25 to 44 year olds, people that were middle and higher income, and people with college degrees was the biggest gaps in the outflows. So we're losing tax base.
Right? Yeah.
Right.
You know, and then you look at last year, we passed the millionaires tax, right? And
that taxes are so high in comparison.
Yeah, and it's like to say, like, okay, we're going to throw a millionaires tax on there. That's all well and good, but if the millionaire leaves, then what do we got? Like, I'm no millionaire, but I'm like, I don't think the answer is taxing them and making them run away. I want them to stay here and just keep paying taxes equal like everybody else is. Like,
right.
No, let's leave them here. Let's get their revenue. But, you know, the report was really thorough and it had a lot of good charts and everything, but it was pretty alarming when you see the people that are leaving and it's the taxpaying base. And we're looking at cities now having tax shortfalls on the real estate side, mm-hmm. Boston in particular. So it's a bleak picture, and that's nothing to say of, they do have a great point of, you know, how much is housing having to do with this and how much is it NIMBYism and regulatory stuff. You know, we had Sean on here last week. Sorry about my soapbox. We had Sean on here last week, you know, talking about $100,000 before a shovel goes on the ground just to get a permit for a three family.
Right.
It's crazy.
Joe, let me just get to the comments really quick. So I think, is it Chris?
Yep.
Until salaries equal to cost of living, staffing to support the ever increasing regulations will always play catch up. And then he also goes on to say, in my department, people come to me with bad experience baggage, assuming I'm going to be difficult. So they start from an adversarial position. Mm. And then Jose says, it's hard for small contractors to plan the pipeline when you can't predict when your permit will be approved.
Yeah, but that's what we talked about last week. Time is money, right? And that's, you know, some places have the idea of, you know, you got to pay to play. You're gonna have to jump through hoops if you're going to get this permit. That's how a lot of municipalities think, believe it or not. So
but
even businesses. Right, a lot of business owners aren't that well versed in what's needed, and the theory of, look, you got to jump through hoops, and yeah, people are adversarial because that's, I think the majority of treatment or the majority of people they speak to, that's what they're dealing with is the you know, the fact that people aren't treated that well in other departments and in other places. The majority, I'm gonna say majority, because that's I think it's true, is the majority, but.
Yeah.
I mean, I think we're hitting all around the topic here as to reasons, and, you know, Jose, that's absolutely right. If you can't predict, you know, when a job's going to go on in the ground, and Chris, as he said, until, you know, income, you know, matches the cost of living in departments, you know, that's a whole other issue. Municipal management of money and where the money's going, and redundancy at the top as opposed to the boots on the ground. That could be a whole other episode. Mm-hmm. Here in Massachusetts, we have school departments right now that are laying people off because they have a shortfall, but yet there's a superintendent, an assistant superintendent, the assistant superintendent, the staff member to assist the assistant superintendent. You know what I mean? Like the redundancy at the top.
Yep.
And yet the people with the boots on the ground that are educating the kids, that's typical Massachusetts. That's how I look at it.
Couldn't agree more. Like, the as soon as like there starts to be money issues, it's like, oh, we gotta fire, you know, cut police, fire, and teachers,
right?
Or building inspectors or whatever. Like the people that are actually out on the front front lines actually doing the work, but you know, the lieutenant governor's nephew that has a fucking, you know, do nothing job for $150,000, that job never gets cut, right?
Right.
So big companies do that too. I mean, the same way. I feel like sometimes when they try to cut back, they don't look at like the hierarchy. Just easy to cut the lower positions, and it doesn't really make a dent, you know.
Yep. So then it all contributes to everybody's attitude about the state and attitude about working with public agencies, you know. And to Chris's point, like, he's spot on. Like, the pay is usually not really there for that frontline worker, you know. It's there for higher ups, and you know, so you're trying to attract good talent. But I often said, if a building inspector is making half of what someone out in the industry is making, yes, there's pension, which is a benefit. Yes, potentially less hours than someone who's working 50, 70 hours a week. But if you're making half of what the person out in the field is making, are you going to get the best people? You know, this is the person that, you know, you're supposed to be overseeing and making sure everything's being done by that person, and that person's making double you. So what are you going to get? You're not going to get the best of the best. And then you look at Boston, and I'm sure there's other towns where there's residency requirements. So now you've shrunk in the pool even more. And then, you know, and then you wonder why we struggle to get good people. Yeah. And it's a challenge. But I don't know, it doesn't bode well. And I don't really see a path forward as far as housing goes or any of the other bureaucracy stuff. It just seems to just continue to keep pile on, and I don't know where it ends.
Yep.
So I wish Tim McCarthy just heard everything we just discussed about that. He would have certainly had probably some good input. But yeah, so that's it. We're losing 25 to 44 year olds. We're losing people that are the tax base, and you know, it's not a great picture here for Massachusetts.
Do you think, really quick before we move on, I mean, and sure. I actually think I know, but I mean, I think during COVID, right, people left Massachusetts too because everything was closed here. So I know so many people that went elsewhere, and then now with flexible work arrangements and being able to work other places, you're saying like a younger pool of people too. I mean, I'm sure there are people that might still work in Mass, but might live in Florida or other communities. And I think that really played, I know it was happening before people were migrating out of here, but I think mm-hmm. that really played a huge role.
Yeah. And that's a big problem is, how do you get the downtown offices filled back up? Mm-hmm. Because just the knock-on effect of not only the taxes that are being lost, but then how many sandwich shops or, you know, other things go out of business because all the workers were the feeder system for that. And, you know, I think about what, you know, Greg Garvin wrote a piece during COVID about resiliency, and, you know, the downtown office market was very monolithic, and, you know, there was no mix of stuff in there. Now they're starting to do better about mixing residential in with office and stuff like that, but Boston and so many other cities have a big challenge to try and get people back into those offices, and when we're losing population, that doesn't bode well for that either.
Yeah.
The next topic was solar bonds. Yeah, you know, I saw this, just the headline itself, I was like, you know, what the fuck is a solar bond, and what is this for? And you know, I read through it, and it's basically, and then I thought of, you know, when you have billboards, cities and towns will take bonds on the billboards, because what happens is, you know, 30 years later, you got this rusted billboard on top of some building or out in a field, and they can't get a hold of anybody to take it down, and they want to have the ability to take the billboard down, or in this case, to take the solar panels off. And 20 years from now, if they're outdated and or technology's changed or whatever, and a person doesn't want to pay to remove them, is there hazardous materials? How do you get rid of that? All these questions around it. So there's a new bond that has popped up around solar bonds. And the one other thing I'll say before I ask for you, before I hear from you guys is the guy used the term, he calls it the squirrels and trees bond. And what he's saying is not only do we have to get rid of the solar panels when they're at the end of their useful life, but you then got to turn around and replace all the natural habitat that got destroyed because you've covered all that ground, and now it's barren under there and there's not animals and there's no, shrubs and trees and all that other stuff. So the bond would be to kind of replace the habitat. So that's what they are. And then I'm going to let Daisy out and you guys tell me what you think.
Right. So stop me because I'm going to roll here for a
Go
little
for it.
bit. You know, when we first talked about this, I was like, I don't know. I don't have anything. And then in typical fashion, I started to digest it, and there's a lot to unpack here. So stop me because this is gonna be a long roll here. So first, people have to understand Massachusetts in zoning, Boston aside, has protection for installation of solar panels, right? In Mass General Law 48, it actually says you can't restrict the installation of solar panels. So over the years it has happened, and municipalities have restricted it and said, yeah, you can only put them here, or they only allowed them on houses and not ground-mounted solar. So now the push towards green energy and renewable energy has seen obviously an influx of solar panel projects, and there have been a number of court cases, Lexington being the most significant, where the state said, look, Mass General Law 48 says that you can't restrict the installation of solar panels, right? And what happened was in Lexington, and there's another case as well, is they said, all right, you only have like 1% of your land allowed for the installation of solar panels, ground-mounted solar, right? Which is it's in proportionate. You need to have a larger amount, and I forget what the number was, of land set aside, zoning districts where you can actually install solar panels. So the applicant that wanted to install the solar panels won in that case and said, no, you can't stop them. They can install it. Municipalities can come in and put regulations in, but you can't over-regulate the solar installation. All right. So that's kind of the setting the tone for what's going on. Now we have green energy, we have the push for solar. We have two different groups that are now really part of the same group that are now at odds because you have the solar installer who wants the green energy, and I'm going to be frank, they want the money, right? Because there's money in green energy, all right? And now you have the conservation people who are saying, look, you're taking this field that was once a field or a farm, and you're putting structures on it. What's the adverse effect? So that's kind of the background of what's going on. Now, this idea of solar bonds, it's not new because in municipalities now, for cellular antennas and for cell towers and buildings that install cellular antennas, most municipalities have a bond requirement for removal so that the company AT&T or Sprint goes out of business and merges. They don't just leave their antennas on the building, right? So there is this concept already in place for infrastructure for these types of installations, not solar, but cellular, right? So here's the problem. Just like everything else. So you can pass this, right? You can put this in effect and say, yeah, you have to remove it, right? But a couple of things. One, bonds expire. You need to renew bonds, right? So if you have a solar installation that's 6 acres, 2 acres even, and it's going to be there for 30 years, I mean, even on a sidewalk or on even these solar, I'm sorry, the cellular installations, those things need to be renewed. That's a whole other department keeping track of what bonds are active and what bonding company. Is it the same company that owns the building or the antennas or now the solar, right? So those things need to be renewed. Who's keeping an eye on that? Whose responsibility is it going to be? Is it going to be the state? Is it going to be in the municipality? Does the municipality even have, like we just said, the bandwidth to keep an eye on what bonds and what locations, right? Because these are everywhere. So the solar fields and the solar insulation. So I get it. I think we just segued from more regulation. I think there's a need for it because, yes, yeah, solar panels don't last forever, they can be maintained, but they don't last forever. So what do you do with them, you know, when they've gone beyond their life? Or, you know, we go to some different sort of renewable energy and they're not needed anymore. Whose responsibility is it going to be at that point? Right? Try to get solar panels taken off your house when you don't want them on your house anymore. That alone, never mind a solar field.
Yeah, no, I mean, and that's historically been, well, one of my objections to not putting solar panels on my roof, because like everybody else, you get everybody showing up and wanting to put them on, and it's free, and you do this, and you get free power, all this stuff. But at the end of the day, I want the least amount of holes in my roof as possible. And the thing is, if something does start leaking, who's coming to take the panels off? That's what I usually ask them. Like, will you guys come and remove the panels if my roof leaks?
Right.
You know, oh, well, we have to. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. The answer is no, you won't. And then it's my problem dealing with these things. Or, you know, you see even like hailstorms. Because I started like poking around after I was reading this, and there are places where they're having hailstorms and there's acres of solar panels now ruined. Like, to your point, is that what insurance is that?
Right.
Who pays for that?
Yep.
But yeah, there's you're right. This isn't a new concept, right? Like I was saying, billboards. I think I've seen those things before. It's not a new concept, but yeah, how do you manage that? Like you said, who are these things getting renewed? And it ties in kind of nicely to one of the articles in Contrarian Boston, where there's a couple of legislators that are in Massachusetts are getting Massachusetts Clean Energy Center, who now exclusively looks at wind and solar. They're not allowed to look at nuclear.
Right.
This, I don't know if they're senators or reps, but they're putting forward a bill to have MassCEC look at nuclear power as an option. And they're looking at Connecticut is opening, and they have new smaller ones that are like less hazardous and more efficient. And Dominion Energy is putting one of them in there in Connecticut. And then you turn around and you say, like, okay, well, what if that happens?
Right.
And then
yeah,
wind and solar are go out the door.
Wind, we could have a whole other conversation on wind and the effect, and you want to talk about two the same group splitting as far as green energy and environmental with but anyway, I don't want to, that's a whole other episode.
Yeah. And then there's going back to kind of what you were talking about, the solar regulations, Mike, is, you know, fire safety issues when these are going on roofs. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people that are putting them in and not leaving walkways, so fire departments can't access roofs, they can't vent roofs, as far as
egress, the big one now is egress, getting out of your, you know, your dormer to get onto the roof, you know, out of an egress window. Yep. That was one of the code changes that we went through this year. So
what is your thoughts on, you know, because you see these pictures and even videos of mountainsides covered in solar panels, and, you know, the videos put out there like, wow, look how amazing this is. You know, I look at that and I think it's, excuse my language, it's fucking criminal. I think people should leave in handcuffs that are doing that.
Yeah.
What do you guys think?
I mean, so I used to go, you know, spend a decent amount of time in Vermont, and that was the thing there was, you know, and I get it. The farms weren't doing well. All right. So you're in this rural area and the farmers started selling off their land to the solar companies because it made sense. They were offering them a boatload of cash for the land and they were putting in these solar farms. Right. It's absolutely terrible. It's awful. They don't just sit there. Right. They're not sitting on, you know, helical piles are this small. There's foundations. You have to put a foundation in the ground. Then they got to be maintained. Then they got to be fenced so people don't go in there.
Yeah.
Because there's a shitload of electricity flowing through when you have a solar farm, right? So they got to be fenced. So now you have in a rural area that was, you know, quintessential New England, and this goes for anywhere that you know, is rural or is a hillside, a scenic, and you're smashing these solar panels in, right? And you have to excavate. You have to put the foundations down. There's no environmental impact. People are full of shit. if they keep saying there's no environmental impact by installing solar panels, right? The water percolates through the ground in a different manner, right? Yeah. There's a bunch of different things that go on when you install these large scale. And I'm not saying they're all bad, right? There is a location and there is spaces for them, but I just think it's a real shitty look, you know, when you're installing these things in a rural atmosphere or rural setting, you know, for the sake of green energy. It's a conflict. It's a direct conflict, and it's asinine. But
yeah, the green energy that as a result has taken a field, you know, or a mountainside and turned it all brown underneath, right? Not very green.
Right. You know, I have a hard time sometimes agreeing with the conservation departments in towns. I know that's hard to believe. But, you know, there was a project that I was just recently involved in that went to court, where I made a decision to stop a solar field. It was based on the application type. And it's the first time that I saw, you know, arm in arm for crying out, we will overcome with the conservation department, because they were right. They're like, you have this 3 or 5 acre solar installation, which was a farm, right? Which was a horse farm, right up against wetlands. And now you're going to go excavate and add a road in there so that the trucks can get in there to service it and install. It blows my mind, the conflict between conservation and green energy. And if you follow, not to go too far off topic, if you follow, you know, the fishing organizations in Massachusetts, I'm talking the commercial fishing and the, you know, Save the Harbor, Save the Bay people who are historically conservationists. And then you look at things like Cape Wind and companies like that, the leases that have gone out, you know, out in the Nantucket Sound and Vineyard Sound for solar fields, I mean, for wind farms. It is amazing the conflict between the disruption of the environment and the quest for green energy. It's amazing, absolutely amazing.
Yeah. I mean, if you get back to your comment about like the turning, you know, farms or acreage into fields because it's financially an option if there's not much economy there. And the thing is, it's like, I'm going to get on my my libertarian food tirade here, but if the government steps in and throws money at this, it's not the market that is making someone take a field and put solar panels on it. It's because the government is willing to pay that company and use tax credits and all these other things to get companies to be able to make money doing this because they want the green energy. So now that makes financial sense for the farmer in Vermont that you're talking about to turn his field into a solar farm. And the same thing happens with, like, why do we have so much sugar, soybeans, and corn planted everywhere across the United States? Because the government will pay you to do that.
Right.
So, oh, okay, well, now we have all corn and sugar is ridiculously cheap food, and now we end up with an unhealthy population because everything has got corn syrup and sugar and flour in it, and everybody has diabetes now because the government decided to, you know, just to push people to farm certain things. Rather than saying, you know what, farm what you want to farm, and what people want to buy is what people will plant. And I think we've got the same distortion going on in the green energy space.
Yeah, I'd love to hear from somebody, you know, who's on the environmental side, and I'd love to hear from somebody that's on the you know, solar or the wind farm side, the offshore wind. I'd love to hear what their thoughts are, you know, grassroots here, rather than seeing it in a publication or whatnot. So if anybody's out there and they deal with this, let us know. I'd like to know what, you know, the fisheries right now is really up in arms over the amount of, if you've been following the whales that are washing up at an alarming rate right now. You know, I'd just like to hear about it. So,
Joe, we have a comment, maybe unrelated, but did a semester abroad in Ireland with Wentworth. We had to pay for electricity, and it was double the price per kilowatt when converted to U.S. dollars.
Yeah, no, it does matter. And it's funny, recently Mike Weber was on the Mass Construction show, and he was talking about how data centers are what's causing a problem with lead times for electrical equipment, because it's just such a volume of them and they're just sucking up all the resources. And we were looking at it, and it was surprising that Massachusetts has almost no data centers. You go to other parts of the country and they are cranking, you know, and we weren't really sure what the reason was why Massachusetts wasn't, you know, a big part of it. And I think it could be a couple things, just the amount of space we have. But then I was doing a little more research, and the cost of electricity is high here in Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So they're looking, I'm going to put a data center. Am I wanting to pay, you know, 3 cents a watt in Iowa, or am I going to come here and pay 27 cents a watt in Massachusetts?
Right.
Completely off on my numbers there. But, and it's a no brainer because it's so electric. You need so much power to do data centers that the cost of electricity is probably your driving force to where you're going to put one of these things. So it's not unrelated, Zach. It's definitely related, and it'll be interesting to see what plays out. Because if we do go the nuclear route, you know, then you're looking at just almost endless, clean, cheap energy.
Right.
All right, so we have 2 minutes left. What are we gonna do here?
So I don't think we'll go into ProTIV. Maybe we'll save that for next week. I'll do two quick hits. Boston, there was a report that came out that cost of construction has gone up 6.2% from the first quarter of last year to first quarter of that compared to the first quarter of this year. And it was higher than a bunch of other high-cost markets, New York, Washington, San Francisco. So construction costs keep going up in Boston, which I don't know, it seems to not make sense.
Yeah.
The report was from, I never heard of them before. RLB. So if people want to look it up, it's RLB. I think the name's in here somewhere. I'm not finding it. But if you look up RLB construction report, you can kind of check that out. And then the other thing that was a holdover from last week was, I thought it was interesting, Home Depot bought a commercial roofing company.
Right.
And you know, does this mean that, you know, Home Depot is shifting from, you know, contractors with pickup trucks going in there and homeowners to commercial, you know, and will we see Skanska buying stuff from Home Depot soon?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, they have the buying power. The thing with the small, and I say small, but they're big box stores, was, you know, they don't have the bulk or the ability to store bulk like that's needed for a large project like South Station, let's say, or whatever. So
yep.
It'd be interesting to see. But I did not know previously who the owners of Home Depot were. And I believe, I don't know when it changed, but originally, wasn't Home Depot owned by some arm of the Chinese government when they first surfaced in the United States, I believe?
I did not know that.
I'm pretty
sure.
Are
we going to become a conspiracy theory podcast?
No. I don't even think this is conspiracy, but it was not owned by, right now it's owned by BlackRock, and who's the other owner? There's another owner there that are, it's kind of a conglomerate, I think, right?
I have to look it up, Mike.
Yeah, but I'm pretty sure that, but anyway, but yeah, it is interesting to see that they've been historically the mom and pop shop, even though they're a big box store, them to move over to be possibly a distributor in a, you know, to large projects. They've always had the commercial side, the Home Depot Supply,
yep,
which service office buildings and whatnot, things like that. But
to answer your question though, Mike, they did talk about, they have a lot more just not stores, but like lay down area, for lack of a better word, where
right,
it's materials storage centers or lots.
Yeah.
And then the other big one in there is they paid $18.2 billion for it. So it's the biggest investment they've made yet. So they're throwing huge, huge money at this. So it's for real.
All right, you guys, we're over on time. Vanguard Group owns 9.49% and BlackRock owns 7.15% of Home Depot as of December 23.
Oh, so that's only 16%.
Yeah. But that's just quick research right now.
Shareholder.
Gotcha.
Awesome. So next week, same time, same place.
Yeah.
Monday, Marathon Monday. Good luck to all the runners out there.
Oh, yeah.
Good memory. I'm glad you brought
if
it up.
If you go to ISD, they've been doing it in Boston. They have the place all decorated, and you can leave a little note to one of the runners or any of the runners. So if you're in, make sure you support all the City of Boston runners.
And no weekend permits if you're working down
that area. Yeah, we didn't bring that up either, but what's 3, 4, 5, 21, 22? You won't be able to work this weekend. Anything in the street starting Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, and any regular off-hours work is not allowed in those areas.
Good to know. Mike, I'll be cheering you on when you're running down
Route. Yeah, I get tired driving down Boylston Street when I cross the finish line.
All right, we're over. Goodbye.
All right, bye.